Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking to Professor Bill Robertson. He's a professor of teacher training at the University of Texas at El Paso, but he's got a special little twist to just being a professor. He's also known as Dr. Skateboard, and we'll get into all of that. But first of all, Bill, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you so much, Keith. Thanks for having me here.
Tell us, how did you get into a career in science education? What were those early formative periods?
So I was one who really enjoyed school, did well in school, had a very sort of mathematical science mind. It was fostered by a lot of faculty and high school teachers. I went to college and was dual majoring in history and chemistry, and thought I would end up being sort of a science writer is what I thought at some point of doing that. Ended up not finishing my chemistry degree, but got a zoology degree along with my history degree. And at that point was thinking maybe I'll become a teacher or I'll become a geneticist, and was interested in looking at either teaching or doing research. At the same time, you know, I was out working in schools, working with young people, getting a lot of feedback that I was, you know, had an aptitude that might work well in teaching. And I ended up going back to graduate school in education at UC Boulder in science education. Became a high school teacher and a middle school teacher.
Just to sort of interject, if I might, UC Boulder is not some new college in California, it's in Colorado.
That's right, University of Colorado, Boulder. And I went there, and then I began to teach, and I taught in high school in Denver, Colorado, and then moved to northern New Mexico and taught at middle school in Pewaukee, New Mexico, somewhere between Santa Fe and Los Alamos. It was there that I, you know, had an opportunity to go up and work at Los Alamos for a summer. And so I became a teacher research associate and went up there and worked for a summer. And I like to say about that, that was the summer job that turned into 10 years. So I ended up working at Los Alamos National Lab for 10 years in the area of science education. And that was fascinating for me because that fostered my science interests.
Tell us, why does a national laboratory have an interest in having a permanent staff member on science education? Was this sort of outreach that they would send you to the schools and say, hey, this is the science and this is what Los Alamos is doing?
Yeah, there was a big component of that. You know, it was both outreach to the communities. This is the science we're doing at Los Alamos. How can we integrate it into the school curriculum? That was a big part of it. But it was also inreach, bringing teachers to the laboratory, bringing students to the laboratory, graduate students, undergraduate students, high school students.
So was your responsibility to go out there and recruit people to come for summer sessions, for example.
Right. I was part of a team that did that. And so, yeah, we brought people in, and then we also developed curriculum that we could bring out to the schools.
How did you like that?
I loved it personally. You know, someone, it really fostered that interest in science. And the other thing about working at the National Laboratory was you really understood the interdisciplinary nature of science. Things at Los Alamos, people kind of center them on one area or one topic around things nuclear. But really, it's a hugely interdisciplinary area. It's been that way since the start. It's got an incredible history. My dad was in World War II, so I had a connection in many ways to understanding that part of the history as well. So for me, it really fostered sort of my interest in science, but showed me really how science works in an interdisciplinary manner.
It's true, because I remember several years ago, a team from Los Alamos came down to Ciudad Juarez across the border to try to improve the way that they had made brick kilns, because up until that time they'd been using a lot of rubber tires to generate the heat to do the baking to make the tires. And, you know, I was amazed that here was Los Alamos, you know, this icon of sort of rather high-level research and thinking and engineering, coming down to worry about brick kilns.
Right.
I don't know how successful they were in the end, and in fact, one of my friends here on campus, Nick Pingitori, he sort of came out with a waggish sort of comment that right in the end, they just made to make better tires that weren't quite so messy to burn.
Right.
But I'm sure Los Alamos did a better job. But you hit on a point that Los Alamos has a very, and National Labs in general, a big, big brief.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, people do not think about it in terms of physics, but I mean, you know, chemistry, biology. One of the things Los Alamos did is they mapped chromosome 16 for the Human Genome Project. They do a lot in sort of global climate change studies, dealing with, you know, systems modeling. And that was really, you know, a way of seeing how technology could be integrated into science as well, because, you know, there were a lot of limits on the types of testing you can do at Los Alamos. At the same time, there were tremendous advances in the use of computer applications. So that was also a time that I not only learned a lot about science, but I learned a lot about using computers, using tools for on the internet, and developing web-based tools that could be delivered to students.
It's interesting. Let's sort of look at the bigger picture from, in the sense of training teachers to teach science. You've been doing this now for a long time and thinking about it for a long time.
Right.
What would you say are the big changes that have come about in, say, the last 20 years, and how successful have they been from your professional point of view?
I'd say there's a couple of big changes. You know, first off, I would say in the way that students learn is a big change because of the amount of information that students are exposed to. You know, we have an expression in teaching or working with teachers is, you know, we teach the way we were taught. And so I think one of the things that we recognize is that sometimes the way we teach, the way we were taught, is not going to work so well with a student today because in many ways we were gatekeepers to information and passing that on to students. Students today can have quick access to all the information. So I think one of the transitions is trying to change the role of the teacher from less from delivering the content in the classroom and sort of facilitating the learning experience. So giving experiences first, hands-on, guiding students through these pieces and then having them, you know, learn the content once they've had an experience. And in many ways, that maps really well to how scientists work. Scientists do stuff in the field, and then they come back into the lab and try to make sense of it. So in a sense of trying to teach teachers, yeah, I think in some ways it's trying to teach them to act more like scientists. Further on, I guess, with the student, they learn differently. So one of the things I've really started to do is try to figure out how can we produce content that is readily accessible and interesting for the student. And a big part of that is to try to develop primary content that is video-based. And so students today seem to be very able, ready to consume video content and less about textual information. I've worked with a lot of students, and the things I always notice is you'll ask them about something, they will go and watch it on YouTube before they ever read it. And I think that that's how they learn. They want to see it and then perhaps do it and then go and read about it. So
I can see that because cooking, the number of cooking programs there are on television
right.
and videos downloaded. My aunt in Canada, she's 101 next birthday, and her grandson, I guess it would have been, about 10 years ago, made a video of her making what we call in England Yorkshire puddings, all right? And he just watched her doing it and had her talk about what she was doing.
Right.
And then he put it on the internet, and it's got hundreds of thousands of hits,
right?
All right? And my aunt, she's amazed by this, but every time she sees it, she said, I wish I'd known this was going to be, you know, seen by people that have cleaned the oven.
Right.
Because, you know, the door to the oven with the glass is a bit streaky.
Right.
But, I mean, it's amazing to me. But somewhere along the line, getting away from text cannot be good.
No, I'm with you. I think the thing I think about as an educator, and I would classify myself as a constructivist educator, and that means someone who builds experiences that people can use to then understand the content. And the content is king in all of this. It really is. There's no getting around that. But I think about it in terms of like maybe how we learn to use our phone. Let's say when I get a new phone or a new gadget, you know, the first thing I do is I play with it. I try to figure it out based on what I already know. You know,
you certainly don't read the instructions. Is what you're saying.
That's right. You don't read the instructions. And when do you read the instructions? When you have a difficulty or a reason to know. And so I think to me sometimes it's not that you have less content. It's the timing of when you bring the content in. And to me, that's the difference between, say, being a constructivist educator who gives people experiences and then provides the content versus a didactic or traditional educator who gives a lecture, gives content, and then asks students to do something with it. So that's sort of the balance. But ultimately, the content is king, and the validity of that content is what drives change.
How do you evaluate this change then? Have you seen an improvement over in high school students coming out or university students graduating in their ability to handle mathematics? And I'm looking at it from a scientist's point of view.
That's right.
You know, physics, chemistry, math, engineering, these are tough subjects. And it's not always so simple to do a video and say, hey, this is the Laplace theorem or whatever.
Right. So for evaluation pieces, you know, I've done a number of interesting projects here where we've worked with science and we've integrated video. One of them was a trip we took through a NSF IPY Rome grant where we took students and graduate students, undergraduate students and teachers to Antarctica. We went in 2007, 2008.
I remember that. Well, that was Craig Tweedy's operation.
Yeah. It was fantastic, you know, and worked with Craig Tweedy, Vanessa Loheed, Aaron Velasco, and myself, we went. But the big point here was that, you know, students were getting a lot of content. They were really having to learn about these things because in many ways it wasn't just that the science was important, which it was, but it was also life and death in some ways because you're out there in Antarctica. The other part was that, you know, the motivation, the reason for doing it, sort of the big picture, what drives you, that intrinsic piece. I think that's another piece that we as mentors and scientists foster in young people. And I think it's people can be smart enough. You know, it's just are they committed and motivated enough? And that's, I think, a place where the timing of things, the use of video, the engagement, along with the mentoring and the close delivery of understanding of content is really important. Ultimately, you know, I think that's where faculty members like yourself and Craig Tweedy and Aaron Velasco and others, you know, we manage that part of the process for them, and we understand what high-level science is. And so we get them to demonstrate that learning, not just take a test.
Are you familiar, or do you have a listing or a catalog of good videos that you could recommend, or a place to go for the parent out there listening, or for the student, or for professionals like myself, and say, look, there's a wealth of really good videos out there that help demonstrate some basic scientific principles?
Yeah. So first, I'll plug drskateboard.com, you know, as a place you can go on YouTube as well to get some things related for the middle school, primarily for the middle school student and high school and middle school teacher. I would say, you know, one of the ones I've seen really good stuff come out of that is NASA. NASA has great resources for the general public. They have it for teachers. They have it for scientists. And it's done in a way that's, I think, very approachable and very interesting. On the other side, let's say mathematics, you know, the Khan Academy has gotten a lot of...
What Academy?
It's called the Khan Academy, K-H-A-N. And these are self-produced videos by a gentleman named, his last name is Khan, but he got funded through the Gates Foundation to teach general principles about mathematics. And now he has a catalog of over 3,000 videos, maybe even more, that are used in schools across the nation. So that's another really good one that is coming out. But going back to, say, the Antarctica project, you know, we developed videos and visual content that could be used there as well. So that's available here through UTEP.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and our guest today is Bill Robertson from the Department of Teacher Education at the University of Texas at El Paso. And we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Hey, Dave. We both enjoy a good margarita, especially one made with high-quality tequila.
I do. But did you know the same plant used to make tequila also produces a sweetener? It's called agave, and researchers believe it may lower blood sugar levels and help people maintain a healthy weight.
That sounds like a contradiction, but it isn't, since agave has no calories. It comes from the agave plant, which is also used to make agave nectar. But unlike the nectar, which has calories and raises blood sugar, agave doesn't. Agave is a natural form of the sugar fructose called a fructan.
This is the key difference. With fructan, the individual sugar molecules are linked together in long chains, which makes it a non-digestible dietary fiber that won't raise blood sugar levels, but does have a sweet flavor.
But the agave nectar has fructan that has been broken down into individual fructoses, like high fructose corn syrup, that the body can use, raising blood glucose levels and contributing to diabetes.
When scientists added agave to the water of obese mice with type 2 diabetes, the mice ate less and had lower blood sugar. The mice also had increased insulin as well as a hormone called GLP-1.
This hormone slowed digestion, helping them feel fuller so they ate less, lost weight, and had lower blood sugar levels compared with mice given other sugars, and even aspartame.
These studies need to be verified by human trials to look at the long-term consequences of ingesting agave. The only known downside to the sweetener is that it's not as sweet, but its benefits could make eating a lot more fun for diabetics.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pennell, and we're here talking with Bill Robertson, Professor of Teacher Education at the University of Texas at El Paso. Before we went off, we were talking about your whole idea of using videos and new methodologies, new technology to impart information.
Right.
That's one aspect where I see big changes have taken place in the last 10, 15 years. There's another area, and that is this concept of peer-led learning, where we take bright students that have just taken the class, maybe only a year before, and you give them about 8 to 10 students currently, and that seems to be touted as a better way to get education concepts across, in a sense that perhaps the student this year is more prone to understand the matter if he can talk to someone who's just recently taken, other than an aged, venerable professor.
Right.
Talk to us about this.
So the ideas around peer-led team learning, you characterized them right. I also think that the place for them is maybe in courses where they have large lecture halls originally, have hundreds of students, and they're looking for a smaller sense of community and a chance for students to engage with material in sort of ways that are maybe not as competitive or high stakes as might be just for an exam or something like that. And I think the idea of using a peer as someone to impart the material is fun. I think it's a good idea. But I also think that there has to be a close relationship with the professor. In many ways, I think it mirrors the traditional professor-TA relationship, where the TA just has responsibility for guiding students through the content. But that student has to also understand a little bit about how to teach, not just the content, but the method, how you can get people to learn. And that's a skill within itself. So I think it's something that, necessarily needs guidance, but also students can be better equipped for it over time. I would think that juniors and seniors would be better suited for doing it with freshmen and sophomores, and that if they could do it for multiple years, it would be more beneficial.
I mean, one of the arguments against it from several of my colleagues around the country is that usually when you see this type of an operation, there's a reduction in the contact between the professor and the student. That is because they're taking a chunk of time
right.
that would normally be associated with professor-teacher and now making it peer-led learning student
right.
interaction. Why is it that way? Why don't we just add on?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a good point, is because a lot of times you do. You sort of give up a lecture, if you will, and replace it with this idea of developing these small communities which are led by the students, not necessarily by the professor. Although the professor will meet with all the students who are leading these sessions at a separate time to plan and debrief. So why don't we add it on? One of the big things is that, our students are looking for opportunities, are balancing their life and their work here on campus. But I also think that, one of the ways we could add on time in doing this is using some of the technology. So that might be a way of developing these communities, not always having to be face-to-face or hands-on materials, but maybe interactions with the professor that could be done online. And I mentioned the video. I think that's another way where a professor could do small vignettes on topics that could be difficult for students to understand, and the students could access them not only in terms of their lecture, but when they're out doing whatever they want to do, they could access that content at any time. So I would advocate for professors doing more short videos on difficult topics that would help provide more presence into their class.
I can see that's a good tool. But I remember when I was at the University of Toronto, as a graduate student in Canada, and I remember the first time they brought in television videos, I guess you call it, or programs for the undergraduates.
Mm-hmm.
And, they dropped it after about 6 months because students just, coming in and, God, it's another television program. It's got to have a bit of a zing to it to maintain attention.
Yeah.
That's a nice segue into this whole concept of online classes. I mean, I listen to public radio a lot, and you cannot get away from the advertisements from Arizona State University that has 60 online, completely 100% online courses.
Right.
So the student would never, in fact, ever sit, as far as I can tell, in a lecture hall or even maybe go sometimes to a laboratory.
That's right.
Because they even have online virtual laboratories, which that's an oxymoron to Keith, but never mind. Tell us why this has become such a big feature, and all universities want to do it. Is it simply a matter of saving money?
So I can. I think I'm qualified to talk about this because you know I've been working in the provost's office and I direct a. So I'm associate provost for academic technologies and work with a unit called academic technologies here on campus, which does traditionally a lot of the you know the design, development, implementation of technology enhanced hybrid and fully online courses. UTEP has a new initiative through Extended University called UTEP Connect, where we're trying to build these kinds of fully online programs and deliver them. You know, it really does – they are a place where there is no on-ground contact, you know, so they are completely fully online and students take them at a distance. I think one of the things about the approach we've taken at UTEP is that we're trying to find ways to serve our community. And a place like Arizona State you mentioned or Southern New Hampshire University, which are just trying to enroll students.
Just wherever they are.
Wherever they are. You know, we want massive numbers of students. That's really not the UTEP approach. I think one of the ways is to try to better serve our area. And online programs serve populations like Fort Bliss, the soldier or the family member who's been stationed and perhaps rolls out of here and could continue their education. What we would call the non-traditional learner, which is a lot of our students here, people who are parents and, you know, having jobs and are working, and, you know, professionals. So I think this has, you know, it certainly has a place for a specific population. I don't think it's for everyone. And I personally think that, you know, the best way to integrate technology into teaching is to use it in the classroom and maybe to use it as more of a hybrid model where you meet sometimes on campus and then you present content offline where people can discuss things. So, you know, I think that's a big push for our students, a specific population of students in fully online, but I don't see it as replacing the university itself. I think we still have to have the human contact, and I think we need to model what we want students to learn. And so I think these experiences we can build up with technology, we can supplement with technology, but I think there's a spectrum that runs from sort of this face-to-face to fully online, and I think the middle is the place where it's going to really can grow at a modern university, and that's the hybrid experience.
You're an experimentalist. By definition, you go out there and skateboard all over the place. We'll come to that in a few moments. But can you see the concept of online virtual laboratory experiences? Are you familiar with this? Have mm-hmm. you sort of studied what's out there? And do you have a sort of preliminary opinion about what's good and what's not so good?
You know, I have studied it, and the area I'm working in right now, one of the things I've learned quite a bit about is how you design sort of interactions, these ways that you can make things happen online, if you will, on a website to simulate something that you'd be doing in real life. I think personally, if you think about it in terms of games, video games are very immersive experiences. And when we look at the way we might train doctors or train police officers or, you know, people who are going to be in life-threatening situations.
Airline pilots,
okay? We don't want them necessarily to go up and do their first try with a live patient or live people. We want to run them through these kinds of simulations. And I think if we think of it in terms of those types of immersive experiences, developing something, then I think you could do something that was more like a lab you would do, which is has an immersive component to it.
Then bring them in to do the real laboratory.
And then bring them in to do a demonstration that they can actually do it. I mean, you could do the same thing with teaching. You know, you could practice in virtual worlds on how you would manage your classroom to get good at it. But if you can't do it with live people, really, what good are you, right? So I think that this is sort of a good way of training. But I do think ultimately you have to be able to demonstrate your understanding.
The Open University in England, which mm-hmm. I'm
very familiar
with. Yeah. Me too. I tried help doing a demonstration for them once. All right. And it was amazing. You know, I had to worry about where the damn shadow of my arms were.
Right.
You know, I'm doing something. They said, no, your arm needs to be sort of over here somewhere.
Right.
And of course, you can't do the experiment when your arm is over there. It needs to be here.
Right.
So I said, well, change the lighting because right. it's not easy to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Bill, before we leave the online business, I remember a New Yorker cartoon many years. It had two rats sitting in front of a console typing in responses to something. And one rat says to the other, hey, nobody knows we're dirty little rats.
Right.
So the question on online, is there a history that this is beyond fiddling with? I mean, how do you know who's at the other end answering the questions?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge issue, and you know, and a big part for, you know, verifying that the person who's actually taking the course and getting the credit, getting the degree, is the one who's doing the work, right? And so there are a number of technologies, you know, there's ways that you can authenticate that to get into the system, much like you would for your online banking, you know, different ways you can do that. There are cameras that, you know, that can be activated so that in real time when you're taking exams or doing things that need to be proctored, there is a camera that can be used. I mean, are they being used?
They are being used. It's not that they can be. No. Is that the norm for an online course?
It's not the norm for an online course, but I think as you move into sort of online degree programs where you're getting everything fully online, you're seeing things like people having to authenticate who they are during these times. So whether they're using their thumb as a way of validating that like you would at the bank, some type of signature keystroking, the way you use your keyboard as a way of creating a map about your identity.
So again, this has got to be another set of technology to be a safeguard for the technology that you're using.
That's right.
And if you can hack into all sorts of things. I mean, it seems to be nothing that's associated with the internet that you can't hack into. Right. And this must cause great concern. Getting close to the end of the program, I've alluded to you as Dr. Skateboard.
Right.
Talk to us about this.
So I mentioned the part of growing up as sort of a person interested in science. You know, the other part was sort of being Dr. Skateboard. And, you know, I've been a skateboarder since I was a middle school student. It's something I enjoyed. I still enjoy it. I go out here in El Paso. We have great parks throughout El Paso. I participate in a nonprofit, El Paso Skate Park Association. And, you know, it's just something I enjoy doing. I've always done demonstrations because I've been able to compete. I competed as a professional and continue to do demonstrations in school.
When you say a professional skateboarder, do you go in competitions and win money, prizes?
When I was much younger, that was sort of when I first, you know, in the late 80s was doing that. You know, that was kind of how I was trying to make my living. It was one reason I stayed in school, you know. I was like, you know, don't quit your day
job. Skateboard your way through school.
Yeah, it wasn't the big money it is now. But the thing is, yes, occasionally, you know, you get opportunities to do that.
So how do you relate that technique and that expertise to the teaching of science very quickly?
Yeah. So for me, the point is that, you know, a skateboarder is a physicist. A person who is skateboarding is using the principles of flight. So gravity, thrust, drag, and lift, they're managing those forces. They're using Newton's laws of motion. They're, you know, using a compound machine of the skateboard, which has more than one simple machine. There's motion. There's inertia. There's, you know, different forces that are being utilized. So it's, I think I'm making that bridge from actually watching an activity that looks kind of fun and cool, but then breaking it down and understanding that there's a lot of science and math going on within this project.
I'm going to be a shameless plugger, just like the car guys. You have a video. What's it called?
So Dr. Skateboard's Action Science is a video, and this was actually developed in cooperation with the El Paso Independent School District. We did it, you know, a number of years ago.
And is that you on the cover?
This is me doing the handstand.
Okay.
And this is a guy named Morgan Wade who was recently—
doing an aerial activity.
Yeah, doing something in the air, Superman air.
So how can people get hold of this video?
So they can go to drskateboard.com. They can purchase it there. But they can also – the other thing is I put all the videos that are on here on YouTube for free.
Okay.
So you can go and get them as small vignettes or small films on my site.
So all they've got to do is go to the internet, plug in Dr. Skateboard, and – everything is there.
Everything is there.
And
you know,
it's free.
And it's free. You know, the video itself, if you purchase it, it's $10.
Yeah.
But all the videos—
no, they're all going to go to the internet.
Yeah, and that was my point, too, is like, let's give it away because it needs to be used in the schools and the students.
Absolutely. Fascinating, Bill Robertson. What an interesting career you've got. You can play games and you call it work. And fascinating. And thank you very much for being here on Science Studio.
Thank you so much, Keith.
We've been talking to Bill Robertson, Professor of Teacher Education, University of Texas at El Paso. My name is Keith Pannell, and we hope you come back next week. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Vicarious trauma and caregiver stress will be the topics of discussion September 19th at the Wyndham Airport Hotel in El Paso. These sessions are part of a healthcare speaker series organized by the Office of Texas Senator Jose Rodriguez. Learn more under the calendar at mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from Kindred, a transitional care hospital.